Welcome to the first Impact Coffee podcast. I'm Anna from Worldwide Narrative, and we're here to bring you the very first podcast of this fine event known as Impact Coffee. First of all, a very big thank you to Dijkmanske for hosting the event and providing the coffee. This meetup first came about during a stormy summer party where four small passionate businesses decided that they wanted to involve more people in the topics that came up during their conversations. They wanted these conversations to have social impact, to facilitate networking, and they wanted to quench their thirst for coffee at the same time. Worldwide Narrative have hosted and organized these increasingly popular events for the last 12 months. And starting from this particular podcast and onwards, Chris McCormick from Splint will be part of the production team. In this first ever recorded Impact Coffee, he interviews Sarah Prosser from Partnership for Change. Sarah recently went to the Social Enterprise World Forum in Milan, and in this month's Impact Coffee, she tells us about what she learned there.
Hi, Sarah.
Chris.
Very nice to see you here. So you went to the Social Enterprise World Forum.
I did.
If you can just sort of frame it for us, why did you go? What's your special interest in going there?
I think I went. I went because, as it started, because people were saying, we're going to see you there, aren't we? And I was going, yeah, I hope so. You know, hope somebody will think that I should be there as well, you know, from funding point of view. And then it actually fitted very well with Partnership for Change, which is the organisation that I work with and got various other people here from today. We work with empowering people to make their own change and to do projects that will lead to economic, social and environmental sustainability. And social enterprise is one of those things. So it's been supporting, Partnership for Change has been supporting social enterprise kind of thinking in places like Myanmar, where there's a vocational school and a community centre and things being run as a social enterprise, in projects in Ethiopia. And I've been responsible for projects in Norway, where we're just starting to fund something called Tøyen Unlimited, which will be supporting social entrepreneurs in Tøyen, as looking at a way of empowering local communities. So I went because frankly, in Norway, we don't get a lot of international inspiration. We don't really hear very much about what's going on out there. And we tend to meet the same people again and again and again in Norway. And they're doing lovely stuff, and some of it's going to be really good, but it's very, very early stage. And it's very limited. Whereas out there, huge things are happening. And so I wanted to go because it was in Milan, it was in Italy. And that's the first time. It's been running for 8 years now. And the first one was in Edinburgh, in Scotland, in 2008. And then it went to Australia, USA, South Africa, Brazil, Canada, South Korea. And this was it coming back to Italy. Next year it's in Hong Kong, then probably New Zealand. So this is a chance to catch it while it was here. And there were about 1,000 people from 50 countries all talking about completely different ways of doing social enterprise. So that's why I wanted to go.
Great stuff. And who's behind it? I mean, how did it all start up?
I think it all started up by CEIS, which is Community Enterprise in Scotland, set it up with the Scottish Government. Scotland is one of the countries that really is been pushing this as a way of including local communities and inclusive growth. It's been at the forefront of social enterprise, well, at least since sort of 10 years ago. So it started there as a Scottish Government with the social enterprise organisations in Scotland. And now it's been run by a steering committee that picks up people from each of these countries. So now it's a very international steering committee that helps advise the next country that wants to take it.
So it's almost like the Olympics of social entrepreneurship.
It is, except it's not competitive. It's all about sharing, you know.
So. Drawing the best out of competition, perhaps. But, okay, so how was the whole event structured? What were the themes, categories?
Well, it's funny because I went and I offered actually to do this when I saw how they did set up the forum. And they had these four themes. One was called Nurturing the Ecosystem of Social Enterprise. The other one was about social enterprises against poverty. One was impact investment, and the final was feeding the planet. And then they had two cross-cutting themes, which were youth and social enterprises and social enterprise communication challenges. And I thought they were all really good topics, and I thought this is really exciting. Let's go and learn about those. But when we get there, it was actually, I must say, that it wasn't the best organized conference. It was very traditional, lots and lots of parallel sessions that you could never hope to get to all of, so you couldn't really get a sense of all of these themes. All the sessions were like far too many people on each panel, overrunning. It was 40 degrees. It was so hot. But the food was lovely. It was, gosh, they can do their little bites.
The Italians.
So those were the themes, and that's why I went, and that's why it was structured like that. But and they have a different theme each year in different countries.
Right.
But I think when I got there, what I got out of it in terms of structure was more to do with... I think there was a feeling of not having to discuss what is social enterprise. Everyone there knew what it was. It didn't need to be defined down to the last, you know, but is it this or is it that? It was just saying, this is how we do it in our country. And that feeling of, this is a big, diverse field of people trying to do something a bit different. So that was quite nice. There was the young people thing did come out. There were some truly inspirational young people standing up and saying, we're taking this forward by ourselves and we're just going to do it. But on the other hand, there were a lot of ministers from different countries. So it was looking at how it's been coming from the very top of some countries now are really putting it in place from the very top down. And the importance of international development and how big aid and development agencies are now supporting social enterprise as a way of sustainable development in developing countries.
Can you give an example of that? How?
Of the international...
Yeah,
how
they're supporting these social enterprises.
I was going to come back to that a bit later on,
okay.
But if you wanted to, there was a big session called International Development Assistance and the Emerging Role of Social Enterprise.
Right.
So you had the big guns there. There was USAID and DFID from the UK, and CEDA from Sweden, as well as some of the big foundations, and they're beginning to realise that. That if you fund NGOs and individual events individual projects in developing countries, mm-hmm. it lacks the sustainable element. So they're looking to see how can you bring in sustainable business models that are really trying to fix some of the biggest problems of humanity by encouraging a social enterprise way of thinking. And that might be through finances, it might be through individual incubators. They're beginning to really look at incubators as a way of helping international aid. There's one called the Unreasonable Institute in I think it came from America, but it's now blossoming in Africa. And they take people in and work with them really intensely for 6 months. You live together as a group but get very individual tailored support during that time, and from that you can spin out as a much more confident and sustainable sustainable business supporting your community rather than a project-based short-term thing.
Right.
But the other thing I would say about international aid while we're on the subject was that in Norway we've heard a little bit about social impact bonds, and people have been talking about them a little bit dodgy, do we really want to do this or not? But now they're beginning to talk about international development bonds. And so there's all this sort of new discussion about funding around how do we do that side of it, is how... If you, as an international development organisation, took the risk and set something in motion, that if it was successful, the local government would pay for further down the line, that would be an international development bond. And so it's a way for countries that maybe don't have a lot of cash and don't want to take risk on new projects, that the big development agencies could be perhaps taking that risk role. So it's interesting. Things and community shares as another model, and the Shell Foundation was a part of that discussion as well. They were saying that they support energy related social enterprises, and they were saying simply because the NGOs aren't working, they're not built to replicate, to scale, to be sustainable. So they're looking at social enterprise as a way to do energy sustainability in developing countries. So there's all sorts of things happening out there.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to Shell, actually, seeing as you finished off with them. I was just thinking we've got a paradox there, because obviously you've got all the drilling activity in the Arctic, creating a lot of fuss there, and then you've got this paradox that they're working, and they've got the foundation going, and very active. How does that sit with people at these events, do they get criticism? What was your experience there when they were presenting?
It's a very open discussion, and people are very aware of it, which I think is part of one of the big things of social enterprises are that they're transparent. So as long as you say where your money's coming from, who's funding you, who's supporting you, then at least you're not doing anything behind the scenes, as it were. So the Shell point of view, I think there was a very, very passionate Italian minister saying, we've got to do this because this is a way of redistributing wealth. So these kind of questions came up a lot, not taking the Shell Arctic environmental one directly, but in terms of sort of big corporate greenwashing, social washing is now the... Are they going to be able to social wash themselves by funding these kind of things? And he was saying, but even if the funding comes from places that traditionally would have given perhaps a big grant and said, you know, go and do what we want you to do, the governance structure of social enterprises is set up to give the power back to the people to redistribute the wealth themselves. So this Italian was saying it's the only way of locking in the wealth with the people, and that from now on it shouldn't be about redistributing wealth, it should be about pre-distribution of wealth. So that if you as a social enterprise have a rule, which all social enterprises have to, that you reinvest your any profit you make back in the business, and that you have an asset lock on it so that you can't sell it to someone who runs off with all the money and becomes one of the top 1% of the world. The money has to stay with the people that are running it. So the funding mechanisms, in a way, yes, you need funding. Everybody needs funding to get going. And they're saying governments and the big foundations have to fund the infrastructure, the buildings, the training to get these things going, because they're risky. They're very risky things to get going. But once they're going, it should be changing the whole system that eventually will come back and bite the feet. I don't know, but I think that's the thing.
No, I think this is a really interesting point. I was at a conference earlier in the year, and it was presented, this number was presented, 85.
Yeah.
And we're all saying, what's 85 mean? And 85 was presented as the number of people who have the same amount of monetary wealth as half the population of the world. So we have systemic inequality. Yeah. On top of that, the majority, in fact, if not all, of these social enterprise movements are being funded by the 85. Certainly a large proportion of them. And the cynic says, well, what's the hidden vested interest? However, what you've just said there is kind of makes sense, because it's a pre-distribution. It's actually facilitating a movement, and you can't stop that. So I want to pick up on the asset lock bit. Mm-hmm. You said, what is asset lock? Why does that protect that mechanism?
Asset lock is that you cannot... In the statutes of any social enterprise, which is different in different countries, and social enterprise is not a legal form, so it depends which legal form you choose to run your social enterprise as. But they have to be approved to be a social enterprise, which is, even if they're not necessarily a legal form, you can ask to be have a stamp. For example, in England, you can apply to SE UK and get a stamp saying, I am an official social enterprise. And to do that, you have to have within your statutes the fact that you will not distribute your profit to a few owners or to shareholders. So any profits that are made have to be used within the social enterprise. And also, you cannot sell your company to someone and then you take the money and run away with it. That company has to be sold to another organisation with the same mission as the company was originally set up to do. So you have this mission lock and asset lock. So the assets have to stay within the original mission that was defined. But it is a big discussion, and Muhammad Yunus came right at the very end of the conference to have a big discussion with Divine Chocolate about should social enterprises be allowed to distribute dividends. And there's a differing of opinion there. And he is very determined that you shouldn't be allowed to, and we have to be very pure about the fact that you can't have any dividend share payouts from a social enterprise. Whereas Divine Chocolate, which has been set up as based on a sort of cooperative farmers redistributing back to the people who were actually making the chocolate, or not making the chocolate, but doing the cocoa beans, the farmers. They should be able to get some of the dividends. So, but again, in the way the cooperative system is set up to lock in assets to the members of the cooperative. So it all comes back to making sure that the dividends stay within the mission. And I think it's a fundamental part of social business, that social enterprise, that doesn't come out very often. You just hear, oh, a social enterprise is an enterprise, a business set up to solve a social mission. End of definition. But the third part is the governance and the asset lock. And if you don't have that, you're off into a privatization of social issues, and it can be a big problem.
Yeah, yeah. Very good. So moving on a little bit, the events that you attended and seminars, etc. What were the good stories? Was there a good story that stood out that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I thought what I might do is just talk about some of the things happening in different countries, because there was such a big variety, sure. So that you can get an idea of what's happening. But to start with Taiwan, because the Prime Minister in Taiwan decided that his house was not being used to the best of its, not making the most impact it could by him living there. So he's given his house over to being a social impact hub. So now the Prime Minister's house in Taiwan is full of hackathons and activities and social enterprise hub. So it's that kind of thing just keeps cropping up. The Royal Bank of Scotland, I think, is also, they had a very posh executive suite, and they thought, this is used, you know, once in a blue moon. They've given it all over to social entrepreneurs and social enterprise and said, you know, you can use it better than our executives can. So I think these sort of sweet little things. The Vatican, actually, was the other one. We were at, the first day was at the Expo. The big World Expo is in Milan at the moment. As well, and so we were there, and you've got all these different countries showing off their countries through posh pavilions all the way down this huge sort of runway thing, and the Vatican one is being built by a social enterprise, because the new Pope is so cool that he wanted a social cooperative in Italy, which is the form in Italy, to build their pavilion. So you just find these little sort of things. You think, oh, that's cool, isn't it? And the other one I really liked was there's a supermarket in Brighton called Hisby, and they source everything either locally or ethically or from social enterprises, and they themselves are a social enterprise. But Hisby is the name of the supermarket, which stands for how it should be instead of how it is. And I just thought that's such a sweet name, because it's what it should be, you know. And if you can have a supermarket chain called Hisby, and they're starting to open new ones now around Britain and looking wider, and we had Hisby, you know, supermarkets, wouldn't that be nice? So there's a sort of some of the sweeter, or you know, things you remember in a way, but just to sort of touch on some of the other countries, just to go through, just so you get an idea of what's happening and how different it is. I mentioned Scotland because I happened to come there from there. It's just such a coincidence, all this, you know, but they are doing really good things. And one of the big things they're doing is they've actually got it from the First Minister down. The whole of the Scottish government now is trying to support social enterprises. They see it as a fundamental part of their future growth. And one of the big things they're doing is setting up these public social partnerships instead of public private partnerships. So the social part of the partnership means that the public sector will go in and design a new service for the welfare system of some sort, but they'll design it with a social enterprise. And they'll set up and say, what needs do you need for prison services or for child protection services, whatever? And they'll do it with the social entrepreneurs from the very beginning. They'll design it, and then they'll pilot it. Then they'll put it out for tender. And only at that stage, the people involved in the design will probably win that tender, but not necessarily. But at least they know that it's been designed with the knowledge and from the social entrepreneurs.
That's an interesting one, because the procurement process often comes up in discussions. The current traditional, I should say, procurement processes tend to be excluding to that type of thing. So that's an interesting...
The procurement thing comes up again and again, and in Milan it was one of the themes that went on again and again. And Scotland has actually put in place laws now that says that if you are putting out a tender for something over 4 million euros, pounds, can't remember, then you have to have a social clause in there as well. So you have to look not only for quality and price, which is what countries like Norway do, you also have to look for a social value component. So if you're a big foreign company coming in and wanting to do something very cheaply and you say the quality is good, what social value are you going to leave in that local community? So like for the Commonwealth Games, which is a huge great event in Glasgow a couple of years ago, all of the big contracts had social clauses in them, these community benefit clauses as well, which say you have to use social firms, social enterprises in the work. So you can do it if you want to, just Norway doesn't quite want to yet. And sometimes they say that it's, it's too complicated, or the EU rules say we can't. But the EU changed their laws 2 years ago to be able to put in these community clauses. So it's just, if you want to do it procurement-wise, you can. And John Swinney, he's the Deputy First Minister in Scotland. He came to the FAIRD conference last year, 2 years ago. And he says he has to ring up all the local authorities around Scotland to remind them to put in these community benefit clauses. Remember, you can, when you put out a tender, say, I want something for my community back. And so they're using it as a way of empowering local communities.
And do they actually go into dialogue with various social enterprises before they release the tender, so that there is some kind of framework?
That's exactly what they do in these big ones, the private social public social partnerships, right. PSPs. Yeah, that's exactly what they do. They design it. So it's co-design, and then co-piloting, and then co-production, and then it's all this, we do this together. It's not that we just see you as a sort of separate entity that won't ever be quite as good. Because they realise that knowledge is there.
Yeah.
So it's the capacity, the cultural capacity, the deep knowledge of what your community needs is there.
Brilliant.
So, So that's Scotland. Can I talk a little about some other countries? Or do you want to... I mean, just for example, Russia is...
Talk about other countries.
I'm going to. Russia, for example, has set up 18 social innovation hubs. The Ministry of Economic Development and Trade has set up these innovation hubs, social innovation hubs, all around the country. They're going to cover 2/3 of the Russian regions in these hubs. They've now put it into lots of their universities. They've already got 10,000 graduates coming out who've taken social enterprise as a subject. And they've trained a lot of tutors, and I think that's a big thing. They're training the trainers, which is really important. The Netherlands, the Dutch postcode lottery there, which is one of their big foundations, they've said that they think that a green, socially inclusive society really is achievable, and that they're going to start funding social entrepreneurs and green entrepreneurs through the lottery funding. It's going to be one of the big areas of their funding. Mm. Korea has got its own social enterprise agency in the government. That's after last year when they had the World Forum. Ghana said that they've got such a huge bulge in youth now that what they've decided is that they can't possibly hope to solve many of the problems that's going to happen with that huge youth wave that's coming. But if they can instill social enterprise thinking in these young people, they can set up their own businesses and they can set up their own solutions to the own problems that's coming with that bulge. So they're going for a huge great awareness campaign to try and get the youth to take their own responsibility and set up their own social enterprises. That'd be interesting. And Paraguay, for example, they say that the trickle-down economics doesn't work anymore, and there were some very inspiring South American talks about how they need a new model of economic asset lock type of empowerment, you know. And Bangladesh there's a woman there, I don't know if you ever heard of this, Doreen Shahnaz. She's worth looking up on YouTube and finding out about. She's set up something called Impact Investment Exchange, which is going to be a massive great stock exchange for social enterprises based in Singapore. But she's an incredibly inspiring woman, and she's set up a women's livelihood bond, which is going to be reaching out to millions of women through these kind of thinking as well. So, I mean, there's just a huge variety, whether it's, you know, youth bulges or stock exchanges in Singapore or in Italy, which where we were, you know, there was so much, there's been big focus on social cooperatives, because they have a long, long tradition, and perhaps some of the oldest social enterprise thinking through these cooperatives. But they say that now 30% of Italy is below the poverty line. And with all the refugee issues and challenges, they're also having to look for social enterprises delivering those services to help refugees when they arrive in Italy. And that they said they're going from being a welfare system that has now got no money left to a social impact system, which basically is total involvement of all the communities in delivering their own services. So there's this huge variety of thinking depending on your country. And that's what I think was the best thing about the World Forum, is to see that, you know, we're not talking about one thing that's got to be copied. It's totally different depending on what the challenges are for you.
Yeah, very good. You've mentioned youth throughout your commentary so far. What was the feeling at the conference in terms of how they feel they're being met by governments? I mean, obviously it's going to vary from country to country, I understand that, but there's obviously a huge, you know, you read about Generation Y or Generation Z, whatever it is now, where there's a total, not a total lack of respect for authority, but they challenge authority. We're going to do things our way, we're not interested in making loads of money, we just want to make a difference. Is there a feeling that the tide is turning and now they are being facilitated better?
I think to a certain degree, yes. I mean, I think they feel that this is something that fits very well with their values, and therefore the fact that they've been included in the big panels. I mean, they had Mohammed Yunus and five young social entrepreneurs, and the five young social entrepreneurs were inspirational. And Yunus said his usual stuff, which is also inspirational in its own way, but these ones were, we're going to make every young New Zealander, for example, determined that they can change the world. But it's, and which almost gets too much, you know. And I think there is a feeling of, we don't all need to be social entrepreneurs. We still need bankers and graphic designers and all the other kind of skills that help a social enterprise run. And if everybody wants to go in and say, I, as an individual, I'm going to set up something that will help people on the other side of the world, we're just going to end up back in a sort of a very uncomfortable global situation. So it's very much about, what do you have a right to own, as it were? Where does your cultural competence lie, and how can you be supported in that? And I think it depends. I mean, it depends on the governments, but it is getting into universities and schools, and that's where the big mind shift, which is the mindset and the mind shift, is something that came up a lot. Things are happening now, but just a little bit of shifting of sort of the way you're looking at it will make a big difference. And in Scotland now, they have 700 schools have social entrepreneurship teaching, social enterprise teaching, as part of their curriculum or as part of their extra things that teachers can choose to have. But what they do is they say to the children from Barnet School, from primary upwards, that, can you identify a social problem in your local community? We'll help you work out a business that could help solve that. So then the children look at it and they try and come up with some tiny little business model, but they work on it and they solve their own community's problems, and they're allowed to keep that going. So it's not like a sort of 6-week project and then you finish with it. You keep that going through your entire school run and you pass it over to the next lot when you leave school. So it's getting into all the schools there. And then, as we've talked in Russia and various other places in America, there's a lot of... I mean, the universities are saying that within the last 3 years there's such a demand for education in this field. But I personally, I just hope that it doesn't become so trendy that everyone has to be one, everyone has to work like this. It is a way of thinking that you can still be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, and still, as long as you're thinking in this way, it doesn't matter which career you choose, because you can still, if you end up as a politician in some department, say, but let's put the social enterprises into our value chain. Or if you end up in a big corporate office, you can do the same. You know, so it's,
yeah, because what you're talking about, fundamentally, it is instead of going into business for profit, you're going into business to live and to make your local community and perhaps your larger community internationally a better place to live. And that's the essence.
Exactly. With the social, environmental and financial sustainability, always thinking about that. You know, we're not here to do a short-term solution. It's the sustainable, long-term look.
So you said at the start, there's a lot going on internationally, and there is, quite clearly. Norway, I get the impression, is a little bit removed from that international movement in some degree or another, and I'd be really interested to hear from people in the audience afterwards what they think. What's your take on it? What can Norway learn from this, and why is it, if that's true, why is it that Norway is not quite in touch with the international?
Well, I think the obvious answer is that Norway doesn't have to. that a lot of these others are from really big challenges, be it that there's no money left in the government, or that there's the youth bulge in Africa, or whatever it might be. They've got some huge challenges that no public or no private system is ever going to solve by itself. Whereas here, we don't have that the same really massive cuts that are going on to services that people are having to reinvent new ways of thinking just to be able to survive. But I think that's quite interesting for Norway, because I think you should then, therefore, there's so much talk about preventative, you know, early intervention, that you go in before the problems happen and you do the early intervention, for example, in health, that you know, we know there's an obesity bulge around the corner, can we go in and prevent it now? Or immigration, can we go in and actually, before it gets really overpowering, can we go in and do some early intervention stuff? But then you have to be really, really wide awake. And I'm not sure that Norway is. Because even if they decide to do their own model, which is really important, and it must be based something to do with the unions and the Nordic model of cooperation and based in history and culture and all that, you still have to know what's going on outside to be able to learn from mistakes. And a lot of this is about sharing. And I'm just very concerned that they're going to miss a trick. A lot of the good things from Norway are being borrowed by this kind of thinking out there. But are we, us, Norway, really listening to the good bits of what's working? I mean, just the Tøyen Unlimited project that we're doing from Tøyen Område Luft and Partnership of Change have been the first funders of that pot. And we had the first meeting last week. And just sitting around the table with people from... We had six people we're going to get, the first social entrepreneurs, they've been involved in the community. But seeing the benefit of being, first of all, of the network, of meeting each other, and they go, oh, are you trying to do this? And I'm trying to do that. And how did you do that? And just the network of how you can think of income streams for solving your own little problems, local problems, not little. But also just being seen as a resource, and people saying, oh, I've had all these ideas, and just to have a place where they can come and say, can I try this out? Can I really, I think I'm sitting on this knowledge. And it gives people who've just moved to Norway, or been here for 20 years, or been here forever, just such a sense of self-confidence and a place to come and learn languages and skills. And even if they don't set up a social enterprise, they are better equipped to go off and find a job and contribute in other ways. And we're seeing that already, even with the first few meetings. And I just think, if that is a powerful tool for inclusion and diversity and solving problems that, for example, within the Somali community, if they have their own issues to do with diabetes and move activity, physical activity and things, if that's lying out there and the knowledge is lying out there and this can empower them to solve it, why aren't we doing it instead of making this passive society that applies for short-term grants and support in a very passive way, and people get isolated and lonely and have no sense of purpose and they're not recognised? We've got to take that chance.
Okay, before we open up for questions and further dialogue, I want to ask you, because I really like the idea of the Prime Minister of Taiwan opening up his house. So I had this vision that we're all going to trek off to Anne's house, knock on the door and say, "Hi, we've heard that there's a new co-working space here. Let us in."
Shall we?
But if you were suddenly, you woke up tomorrow morning and Sarah Prosser, you had a decision to make, you were given autonomy and were asked to, what is the one thing you want to put in place in Norway to facilitate this social enterprise movement more, to accelerate it? What would you do?
Lordy. Well, I think we've got to do something about knowledge and capacity building. And that's amongst the politicians, amongst the procurement people, amongst the local inhabitants of local areas, what can be done. So I think we've got to have some sort of place where people can go and say, this is what social enterprise is. This, and here's some really inspiring stories and some examples. But we've also got to be risky, we've got to be risk-taking. And I think that's where the Chain Unlimited, I mean, that's what I've chosen to do so far, is to set up this, it's a new way of working, because it's basically, it's the public sector working with the foundation money. And we're hoping, we're already getting signs we're going to get more to get that going and perhaps be able to replicate it into different VDEL and then different towns. But if you can get the public sector to recognise that by working not alone, it doesn't have to be a welfare completely dominated system, but working with the flexibility of foundation money to get things funded through that early risk phase so that they can then become sustainable afterwards. Then I think just you need to sort of start. The problem with it is a lot of them are very small scale, and that's where the beauty lies. I mean, the fact that Toyin is a locally place-based initiative means that everyone feels that they're contributing to the same community, whereas some of the initiatives so far in Norway have been very, you know, one social entrepreneur there and one here, and maybe there's a theme going on there, but they don't have the same we're building our community together feeling. And that's what, so I mean, at the moment, my office is in a building that's going to get refurbished. My office, when I'm working in Toyin, is in a building that's going to get refurbished. And it's quite a rundown building waiting to be done up. So what we did was we got a sticker and we've stuck it on the window saying, this is Toyin Unlimited. And we've painted the wall orange, this colour actually, and said, this is now Toyin Unlimited. And the people come and they love it. And so I think it's just a matter of just doing it. I mean, the people from Hisby, the supermarket, the How It Should Be supermarket, they had this expression, like, get the social entrepreneurs and others should be just getting really annoyed. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to get really annoyed, but then we've got to build the lighthouse and switch the light on. And I think that's where, in Norway at the moment, we're getting really annoyed, and that's beginning. But no one, well, not no one, but some people, very few people at the moment, are building the lighthouse and switching the light on. We've got to actually start doing pilot projects. And somebody high up has got to say, go for it, and we'll fund some risky stuff. And then after a while, you can build and replicate. Great. Rather than scale. That's my other. We replicate rather than scale, usually. So.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to open it up to you people, you lovely people today. Questions for Sarah?
The first question Sarah received was, is there a centralized database of social enterprises here in Norway?
No, it's a good question, because there's been various initiatives to try and get up both. And there's two things. One is a network of each other so that you can find a sort of a database, a list. And the Centre for Social Entrepreneurship and Innovation have been trying to get that going. And it's slowly beginning to set up a membership-based kind of approach to that. But looking at a good example of that is in Glasgow. They've got this GSEN, and they did some really detailed mapping and set up the Glasgow Social Entrepreneurship Network. So that means that now, and that's expanded across Scotland, so you can go in there and you can say, I need a social entrepreneur in Glasgow who to deliver my catering. I'm having a big event tomorrow. I don't want to give it to a profit-making company. I want to use social entrepreneurship for my catering. And you can go in and you can see within your area of Glasgow where you could find such a caterer. Or you can go into Scotland now and say, I want to work in sport. You can do it by theme as well. Where could I find a swimming pool run as a social enterprise? Because I want to go to that swimming pool because I know that my money is going to go into the social enterprise. So you go there rather than to one that you know has been run by a private profit-making company. So there's potential, but it's difficult in Norway because there aren't that many yet. I mean, we almost nearly know each other, not quite. And there are really good things happening in Trondheim, Bergen and other places. So it's not quite there, but they're trying. But the other thing is like the national platform for what's happening in that country. And there's a new one being set up in Denmark called the Centre for Social Enterprises. There's two in Sweden called the Meeting Place for Social Enterprise and Social Entrepreneurship. In the UK, which I always come back to because it's the one I know best, you've got both SE UK, which is the national. They would, for example, you can go in there and you can get little leaflets about what is social enterprise, or I'm a charity and want to become a social enterprise, or you can, and they help actually the politicians write into their manifestos how to include that kind of thing. So it's more of a sort of capacity building kind of knowledge centre. And there's, in Scotland, you've got the Social Enterprise Academy, who would have one-day courses on social enterprise, or tailor-made. You could ring me up and say, I'll pay you to come and give a course to my company on social enterprise. Or they're the ones that go into schools as well and are now doing a sort of accredited qualification as well. So it's lacking here. It's not. There is no one. And so I am, at this moment, trying to set up something called SE Norge. SE Norge. SE. Okay. and we've got quite a lot of interest, and we're just trying to put the final pieces in place, and hopefully we'll get it going.
The follow-up question put to Sarah was, are you saying that Norway is lacking a more collective behavior regarding social enterprise, and that there is too much focus being put on individuals?
Maybe I'm saying that there's bits of the ecosystem. We keep saying the social enterprise ecosystem, which means everybody from the funders to the politicians to the public to the private. And I feel in Norway there is a focus on the individual social entrepreneurs, and we're lacking the competency on the rest of it at the moment. And once that's up and going, maybe that'll help facilitate the individuals to find a more sort of stable place for them to be. And that they can start working in a different way as well.
And the final question for Sarah, what is your view on private-public partnerships that, for example, run kindergartens for profit?
That's a private-public. That's private. That is privatization. Mm. But if you have a public-social partnership, you cut out the private part, because the social part has the asset lock. So if you had social enterprises running Barnehagers rather than private companies running Barnehagers, then you know that if you send your child to a social enterprise, Barnehager, that the owners are not there to make a profit. They can't, because in their statutes, they can't do that. But they're not a public Barnehager. And the same with hospitals, which has happened in the UK. They set up a pot of £100 million in the NHS, the National Health System, for people within the NHS who thought they could run systems services better than the NHS could, because it's such an unwieldy system, that they could set up a social enterprise, and they had a right to apply for this pot to spin out of the NHS to set up a social enterprise. They weren't allowed to set up a private company, but they could set up a social enterprise to deliver health and care services to their local communities as an asset-locked social enterprise. So again, it's not, you don't have private hospitals around the place. Well, you do. I mean, of course you do. but in Scotland, for example, they're very much trying to stop the privatisation and say it's not, that's the, and it's one of, I think you're so right to bring it up, because my hope is that if we are totally transparent and watchful at all times, that this isn't sneak privatisation. It is setting up a new system that is a social enterprise with an asset lock that I'd be happy to send my child to, because I know that the profits are going back to the Barnehager and to child services, not into the pocket of a private Barnehager owner.
Well, let's wrap it up there then. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Pleasure.
I feel richer.
in not my in knowledge money, already. Because we measure it in social impact.
Yeah, we can't measure that then. It's yeah, and thank you for coming.
Pleasure. Well. Yes.
Well, that was it for the first Impact Coffee podcast. Post-production credits go to Chris McCormick from Splint and me, Arne, from Worldwide Narrative. The music used is credited to Ben McCormick and is covered by international copyright laws. If you feel slightly better than you did before you heard this podcast, then maybe you should go get yourself along to the next Impact Coffee, which is held at the 30th of September, 8 a.m. at Dijkmanske Library. That's just a thought.